Welcome to the LarryandFishers.com podcast. I'm Larry Lannon. Janet Chandler has been a teacher at Hamilton Southeastern High School for a long time. She has a special feel for the history of that school. She also wears a number of hats in the educational scene around the entire Hamilton Southeastern School District. I talked with Janet Chandler during the morning of Friday, November 17th. I'm at Hamilton Southeastern High School, and with me today is Janet Chandler, the longtime Hamilton Southeastern High School teacher. She's also president of the Hamilton Southeastern Education Association. Janet, welcome.
Thank you very much, Larry. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you with us today, and there's a lot to talk about. But since you are president of the Teachers Association here locally, I want to start off with that because you've been in negotiations for several weeks with the school corporation. You reached an agreement on a new contract, which was ratified by your membership and also by the school board recently. I've done some publicity on this to try to give some general ideas to the public about this. Obviously, the teachers have been briefed on it, and then the officials of the school have. What do you want the public to know about this agreement?
I think that the public should know that we've been working unofficially on the agreement for over a year. There are multiple parts to it, and though we officially, according to state law, cannot start bargaining before September 15th, we engage in pre-bargaining with agreement from both sides. And so we did that all of last year, where we met at least monthly, and then this summer, in addition to after school starts. It does put quite a bit of pressure on us teachers to meet during the school year because we teach all day and then go to meet with administration. When we were getting close to settlement, I hesitantly asked if our bargaining team members could be provided a substitute for one day that we were going to bargain next. And it was interesting because they had been thinking of the same thing at administration. And so we were we had one more follow-up session in the evening after that one all-day session. So that was very helpful. We're very grateful.
That's a painstaking job. I have done negotiations in the public sector, not with any wages or compensation. And even with that, there are so many details that you have to work on. I know you and I had talked that some of the final things you were discussing were, like, for instance, extracurricular pay, which can be a very detailed thing because extracurricular activities are wide and varied, and how teachers are paid for that can also depend on the type of extracurricular activity that teacher is involved with.
That's true, and that's one of the things that we had worked on all last year was extracurricular pay. And some stipends, no stipends change for this year because of the timeliness. Some people's seasons were already over by the time the contract got settled. But there will be some stipends that change for next year. Some will go down and others will raise. And we did an extensive study of athletics, especially with schools in the MIC conference and schools with us in the HCC, to see if we were in line with compensation for all coaches and assistant coaches. And we found that in some cases we were not in line in either direction, either not paid enough or paid a lot more than what the prevailing wage was. And it was really a difficult decision for us as a union because we typically don't go in to see how we can cut pay. But we were under a directive really not to make the extracurricular salaries go up very much. And so, every dime was accounted for. And it was a very long, painstaking process.
And one aspect of this that we talked about the night that the ratification vote was taken, And before that is that there were some teachers kind of in a bubble who were hired at a time when the pay was very low, and the effort to equalize that pay can be a complicated sort of thing. So some teachers got more pay increases than others, yet based on the information presented at the school board, more than well over 90% of the teachers voted to ratify this agreement. You should feel good about that as the president of the union.
Well, I'm always wanting 100% ratification, so I always think that would be a really cool number, but we had over 94% of the association members who voted to ratify the agreement.
And if you think about why this is happening, why the salary raises were even possible, it really goes back to last year when the voters approved a referendum. It was May 2016. Explain the connection between that referendum vote and the contract agreement you've just reached.
The referendum allowed us to give a raise because of our we don't grow as much as we used to, but we still do have some growth. We still did hire more teachers, and so the referendum did a couple of things. One, it allowed us to reduce class sizes at the elementary level, and so that to reduce class sizes, then we had to hire more teachers, and then we have to pay those teachers and give them benefits. And so the referendum money helped do that. And then a raise was built in the referendum money as well for teachers. And it's not as big a raise as what some people would like, but it is a raise.
And the what money you have is the money you have, basically. And you have to figure out how to spread that out and how to use the money that's available to you. And that's part of the challenge, is it not?
It is. It's like a big puzzle that you have to put the pieces together. And there are always people who have certain interests that, of course, salary and benefits are a very personal item. And so if something impacts you, then, you could be interested in that and you want it to be done to your best interest. Another thing we did this year is we had to comply with the state in trying to equalize the amount of money that teachers make, the differential between the steps. And so in doing that...
By the way, I just want to let people know we are in the high school. Classes are changing. That's the bell. So just so you understand what that sounds about, please go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. Because we were under the charge from the state to do that, we had some steps that were very much out of alignment. And teachers were upset because that they had looked ahead. They were expecting a certain raise. And over the 2 years of the contract, they will get that raise that they were expecting and more, but not this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we had some disappointed people in that regard.
Yeah, the timing is interesting because you have to look at the money and the school year. And actually, this is a calendar year, is this not?
Right. Our raises are effective January 1.
Mm-hmm. Even though the school year goes from August to May, you use a calendar year, and the teachers are paid year-round. Is that not true?
Well, the teachers receive 24 checks, mm-hmm. and it's up to you to decide. Those checks come on the 15th and the last day of the month, the last business day of the month. And so the summer pay, what we used to call the summer pay, teachers can choose to have that paid all year round, mm-hmm. or they can choose to take the summer pay at June 30th, which basically the June 30th check, and then it would be two checks in July and a check in August. So they would be, there's three pays that they can take in addition to the June 30th check.
Okay, so there is a choice involved there, then.
There is a choice. Yeah. However, most people opt to let the school corporation keep the money and pay them twice a month.
Even at their budgeting, more or less.
That's right.
How would you describe the atmosphere at the bargaining table this round?
Atmosphere at the bargaining table is always very congenial. We actually laugh a lot. We tease each other in good fun. We have a very solid working relationship. And I think either side would tell you that bargaining is not, it's a chore, and the fact that it has to be done, especially within a 2-month time frame now set by the state. But it is a pleasure to work with the administrators that are on the bargaining team.
And I must say, just based on my experience, that does not happen everywhere. We should feel fortunate that we have that kind of relationship here.
Right. And since I've been here a long time, I know that it hasn't always happened here as well.
Okay.
So we're very appreciative of the relationship.
Moving on, you've been a teacher here at Hamilton Southeastern High School for a number of years. So I would like you to just talk about the Hamilton Southeastern High School where you started teaching and the Hamilton Southeastern High School you see today.
When the Hamilton Southeastern High School that I started teaching in is, one, a lot smaller than the one I see today that covers 17 and a half acres under roof. I am in the what we call the vintage or classic part of the building. The hallway outside my room has terrazzo floor, and that's how you can designate what the original part of our building is, because no, you don't put terrazzo floor down in schools anymore, most likely. The student population was less than 500 in all four grades when I came, and now we have over 3,200 at this high school, plus another high school with over 3,200 in the district. So 6,400 kids in high school versus less than 500 when I came. So I've seen a lot of change, and it's been exciting.
Yes, it's been a very different place now. And it was exciting. I had a chance to drop by when you had the event of inviting alumni to come back. It was, what, 50 years, if I'm remembering correctly. And although the turnout was a bit disappointing, the people that came, I think, really enjoyed the nostalgia, seeing the building as it is today.
Right. The people who come back, they enjoy seeing where they were. And they briefly want to see the new stuff, but they're more interested in, like, oh, that's where I was in the play, or you know, I played basketball in what is now our library, you know. And so they want to see the old stuff rather than new, more likely.
You're the sponsor of the mock trial team here at HSC High School. I'd like you to explain what that team is all about.
Sure. We started a mock trial team in 2001. And this year, actually, we have two teams. And we'll be competing in county competition coming up in January. And then one of the teams will also compete in the regional and state competition starting in February and concluding in March. And then we have in the past attended a national invitational in Chicago in the summer. So mock trial kind of goes year-round, two different cases to work on, and we're currently working on a case involving intimidation.
And for those who have not seen it, you've done demonstrations at school board meetings. When you say mock trial, you set this situation up just like a regular trial. You have the facts, you have a judge, you have defense attorneys, you have prosecuting attorneys and witnesses. It's amazing to watch.
It is, and it's really fun to work with. I've always enjoyed working with the kids, and we do have attorneys that work with the teams as well. And so that's, you know, we're very appreciative that the Hamilton County Bar Association makes arrangements for that to happen, and they fund the county competition.
I have been honored myself to volunteer in assisting you with your We the People program. This year, my schedule such and my travel schedule such, I haven't been able to, and I really have missed being a part of that. But I would like you to give my audience an idea of just what this We the People program is about. It's actually a class that is offered to students for credit, and you also do competition. So explain what your students are asked to do in this area.
Sure. We the People at Southeastern is taught as a part of AP government, and at Fishers High School it's ACP government. And so students earn a weighted grade for the class and hopefully receive college credit as well for the class. Here they have to take the College Board test in May to receive the college credit and score at a certain level. And within that semester, we also teach the We the People program, which is a program that was developed in celebration of the 200th anniversary of the U.S. Constitution. It was originally a program that was funded by Congress, but a few years ago, Congress took the funding away, and the Indiana General Assembly graciously has put We the People on a statewide level in its budget at the tune of $300,000 a year.
No small amount, the state
right,
budget, yeah.
Right, and so the Indiana Bar Foundation administers the program in the state of Indiana. Several teachers here at Hamilton Southeastern Schools work with other teachers who are learning the We the People program. We participate in training sessions during the summer. And so the program is thinking about the philosophy behind the Constitution, the history of the Constitution in the Declaration, civil rights, and judicial review that have caused the Constitution to be interpreted the way it is, the branches of government, the civil liberties that we have obtained through the Constitution, and then the citizen participation that we hope to gain in present day and also making an international connection. So there are six different units that students are divided in, and they work on crafting a four-minute statement that they are testifying before a congressional hearing, at a congressional hearing, and then a panel of judges, such as yourself, if you're able to help, would ask them questions based upon their testimony or based upon the question itself outside the testimony. And so we practice that so that people have a feel for what that's like, and then hopefully that we get those practice questions where we've got all the questions we get asked in competition. Both junior highs, Fall Creek Junior High and Fishers Junior High, have a program, and they just competed recently along with Hamilton Southeastern High School and Fishers High School. All four of us will be advancing to the state tournament, and there's also a competition for elementary level at fifth grade, and I do know that Sand Creek Intermediate did it last year, an in-house competition, and I don't know if others are planning to do that or not, but it's a great program for all grade levels.
And it should be noted, Fishers Junior High School's team last year did win the national championship.
Right. There's a national invitational for junior high, and any junior high can go, but, typically in Indiana, what it's been is our state winner. And Brown County has won it before as our state winner. Indiana is very competitive, and we the people.
Very good. I want to move on, because I was in attendance at the end of your celebration recently, a couple of years ago, because that when you do the We the People, you bring the practice judges, such as myself, in, and the students, and a group of people. One of your former students was at this particular event, and it was Todd Houston, who's a state representative now. And Todd handed you a Sagamore of the Wabash Award at that particular time. So how did you feel? I know you were surprised that it was by design. So how did you feel when that happened?
Surprise does not begin to designate how I felt at that time, because it was a celebration for the students, and I want to do everything I can to honor them. And so Todd had let Dr. Borff, our superintendent, know, who was also in attendance that evening, that it was going to happen, but I had no idea. And we did not have the We the People program here when Todd was a student. I did have the honor to have him for several classes from freshman through senior year. And I had kind of his whole family, his wife, his in-laws, so his sister. So I knew the families well. And of course he was in school back when the school was smaller and it was easier to know people than what it is now. But I was extremely honored, and I have it framed in my office at home, and I'm very appreciative of the honor. And
when I did a podcast with Todd a few months ago before the most recent legislative session, he's very complimentary on the work that you did with him, and how you had taught him to learn all different aspects and views on a particular subject, and how valuable that is to him even today. I want to move on to another issue, because as someone who's been involved in education for a long time and as president of the association, I had a podcast last year with Mike Barris for assistant superintendent here in Human Resources for the Hamilton Southeastern Schools, and I asked him about the teacher shortage, and he flat out told me he believes the teacher shortage in general is real. So my question to you is, with that supposition, I mean, I think that's you can take that to as a yes, there is a teacher shortage. How serious it is, you can always argue about. But why do you think fewer people are coming into the teaching profession?
I think generations are different, you know, because you haven't called me old, but you know I am.
Well, listen,
I'm an older person here.
I was going
here.
To say, I have no room to speak, so.
And, you know, I think, you know, we hear about, like, you read Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, and you see that World War II generation and the sacrifice that they made. And then my generation is the baby boomer generation. I'm on the tail end of that. And, you know, has the same, you know, type of DNA, I think, as that war generation without living through the major World War II. And so I think that today the job market, one, is much more mobile. People, there aren't going to be as many lifers in professions as what I have been. And I think that goes across the spectrum, not just in teaching. And, of course, people involved in tech, you know, their job is going to change all the time because technology is going to continue to evolve. So, you know, that's one difference there. There's no question in my mind that regulations and laws on teacher accountability by policymakers have had an impact on the number of people going into the teaching profession. It's a profession that is now highly regulated. It's not as well paid as some. And, you know, I think those forces kind of coalesce. You know, every year you get a number saying how good you are out of four. And the system is set up where you can't get a four. You are going to be under a four. And that's just the way it is. And this came about because the business community didn't have any faith in the teaching community that they were preparing students appropriately for jobs and higher education. And there's also, I think, a lack of love right now between the politicians and higher education about their ability to prepare teachers. And, you know, I think about it when recently I went back to school and got another degree, and it comes down to sometimes practical versus theoretical. And I think that sometimes we prepare people very well for theoretical, like this is how it could work, but lack the practical application, you know, that this is how it does work. I do still see young teachers that are excited about their jobs. I come in every day excited. I love what I'm doing, or I wouldn't be doing it. But I do know, too, that in our school district, we had two elementary openings in two different schools, one in each school, that were created after school year had already started because of the size of the classes. And in both cases, the principal said that there was not a quality applicant for an elementary teaching job. And of course, there can be fallout when you split a class after everyone has gone through ice cream social and meet your teacher night. There can be parental fallout when your kid is moved out of one teacher's class into another. And so the principals might have wanted to avoid that fallout as well, but for both to say that there's a lack of applicants that are qualified. And I remember it, of course, you know, I'm a history teacher, I can remember everything, but it hasn't been that long ago when there used to be thousands of applicants for positions in Hamilton Southeastern, and it's not that way anymore.
Hmm. What about I asked you about new teachers, young people getting in, but what about retaining the teachers that are here? Is that also an issue?
We haven't done a real good job of tracking that, I don't think. In my department, we have a number of people who've been here for more than 10 years. So I think there seems to be more turnover at elementary, mm-hmm. maybe more so than secondary.
Okay. If somebody's listening to this particular podcast and has an interest in teaching, how would you recommend that person start planning their educational path for that?
Well, first, I would recommend that they shadow a teacher or at a level that they think they're interested in just for a day. and see what you do. I had a former student who was graduated from school, thought he wanted to be a doctor, and found out he didn't want to be a doctor after all. And so he did Teach for America, and so he was going to be trained for a few weeks in Chicago on how to become a teacher for a couple of years. And so he needed to observe a teacher, so he contacted me, and he asked to observe me. So we started our day with parking lot duty out in the athletic parking lot that year. And, then we proceed inside. We do hall duty. We do these other kinds of things that you don't necessarily think of as a teacher's job. But he, to complete the circle for this student, he did his Teach for America commitment, and then he went back to school to become an attorney as opposed to a doctor. So,
all right. So he had many different explorations.
He did.
In that way. I am amazed at the energy I see from you, and I've been around you a little bit now, last couple of 3 years. You have been in this profession for a long time. Do you ever think about retiring?
I think if I think about retiring, then I probably would retire. But, it's funny, for the last, it's probably been about the last 10 or 12 years, people have asked me, well, when are you going to retire? Well, I used to be able to tell them, well, I'm not old enough to retire, but I can't use that line anymore. So as long as I still have the passion to do what I do and I feel like I do a good job, then, I'm in it. And I have not really designated an end game.
And that's good to hear. I'm glad you're still have that energy and still in the thick of things. Anything you'd like to comment on at all before we wrap this up? Anything else you want to mention to the audience?
Well, I think that it's very interesting that, I guess I would like to go to the perception of public education. Mm-hmm. I've been in public education my entire life other than the 4 years I attended undergrad at a private college, because I wanted to go to a small school since I'd been to a big high school. And back when I went to college, it was a lot less expensive to go than what it is now. But I think that, public education sometimes gets a bad rap, and, anything goes wrong, of course, that's always in the news, where all the things that go right, people don't usually report on that. And so I would encourage people to, come to schools, come to school events, and you'll see a lot of good things going on. And, I think that's my message.
I spent 9 years in parochial school and then went to public school. I've seen both sides. One thing that, and I'd like you to comment on this since you mentioned that before we go, I've always felt that a public school system is part of that communal event that we all have, that communal feeling, and the part of community that we establish, that public school system is a part of that. And if we start more, I'm not against private education by any means. Again, I'm a product of it partially. But without public schools that are strong and people behind them, I worry about how that affects local communities. What's your feel on that?
Well, I think you can see that, especially in small towns. When you've got, cities like Tell City and Cannelton on the river, on the Ohio River, that have a very small number of students. They're close to each other. They should merge, but they have a history of, that just won't let that happen, with consolidation. And they would be much more efficient, probably run, if they were together rather than apart. One thing that's been interesting in this community is the growth, and that has obviously provided more opportunities for students. And though I miss the fact that the school isn't small, where I used to know everybody when I first came, I am so excited for students to have all the opportunities and different programs that we have for them here as opposed to when I first came. And so I think the students win in the end. I think the smaller communities are the ones that struggle, that their life is the school. The school's probably the largest building in the community. It's a place where people can come together on Friday or Saturday night for games and, feel that communal spirit. And I think that's really important, for those small communities and for everyone as well.
And people, I know, don't really understand this. I think most of the 90,000 people or so that live in Fishers don't understand this. Fishers was a very small town at one point and grew into this huge suburb and once had that feeling.
Right. And when I came up here, Fishers had less than 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. And, of course, through annexation, they grew in addition to, you know, people moving in. But, you know, what is now the Nickel Plate District was basically Fishers. Mm-hmm.
Janet Chandler, thank you so much. Really enjoyed talking to you today.
Always a pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
My thanks to Janet Chandler for spending some time with me. Here's a reminder that Adam Awson joins me every Saturday for Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. It's a podcast featuring film reviews of movies currently in the theaters. We also welcome a local guest with ties to the film industry each week. You can find Hamilton County Goes to the Movie podcast at LarryInFishers.com. Just check the link out near the top of the homepage that says Podcast Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. Again, we post a new podcast each Saturday. This is the Larry in Fishers podcast. My name is Larry Lannon. I write the LarryInFishers.com news blog from Fishers, Indiana, a suburban community northeast of Indianapolis. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again.